Welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are joined for this first part of our second hour by Stephen Janis, who comes on this program on a semi-regular basis. Try to make it more regular.
How you doing, Mark?
Good to see you, Steve.
Good to see you.
And he is, of course, founder of InvestigativeVoice.com and investigative reporter. He wrote a report on his news website about doubtful deaths. Now, this is interesting. And by the way, the phone's open to 410-319-8888. Many of you, and this is not jokingly at all, obviously, have lost friends in this city. And you know in your heart something happened to them. And they were not, it was not deemed that they were murdered.
Right.
But you know something's wrong. And Steve, you started investigating this.
I've been working on this story for 3 years, actually, since I started The Examiner. And by the way, thank you for not calling me a blogger. I appreciate that.
You're not a blogger. You're an investigative journalist. You're a reporter.
I appreciate that. Not that I have anything against bloggers. I love bloggers. But anyway, more importantly, because what happens is that undetermined means that the medical examiner can't conclusively rule whether a death is murder, homicide, accident, or from natural causes. So in that case, the medical examiner rules undetermined, meaning, we really don't know. This is a questionable death, but we don't know what to make of it. We might know the primary cause. A person might have had drugs in their system. They might have even drowned. But we don't know how they got in the water. We don't know how the drugs got in their system, et cetera, et cetera. But Maryland has had, since I've been studying this, a very high rate of undetermined cases, much more so than other places. For example, Baltimore City 3 or 4 years ago had 330 undetermined deaths. Washington, D.C. had 87. A city like New York City had about 150 or 160. But what's even more interesting about it is since 2005 now, and the reason I wrote this story is the number of cases classified as undetermined, which basically you can call unclassified deaths, rose by 20%. So it's a phenomena that, in a state and in a city where the homicide rate is always contentious and always a very important indicator of crime, you have all these deaths that sort of fall into this gray area. Now, just to be clear, a lot of these, in the last report, I would say 70 or 80% of the people are intoxicated. So they sort of look at these as drug overdose deaths. But one of the reasons they do that is the state medical examiner said, I don't know how the drugs got in that person's system. I don't know if, I've had a lot of people tell me, you give a guy a hot shot to kill him. So all these things end up in this big gray area that I think raises a lot of questions.
So a couple of questions here. I think the numbers are 987 undetermined deaths in 2007.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a lot.
Yes.
So why would a city like New York with 14 million people, whatever it has now, maybe more, 18 million, whatever the numbers in New York, only have 100 odd when they have probably more heroin addicts than we do and more murders because of the sheer numbers of people?
I've spoken to a lot of other medical examiners in other cities, and what they'll say is that in general, when a person dies of an overdose, they do an investigation and they just rule overdoses accidents. In other words, they say it's an accidental, you put too much heroin in your system and you died accidentally. So the most coroners take, or medical examiners, take that step. For some reason in this city, Dr. Fowler, who is our state medical examiner, has not taken that step for the reasons he says, I don't know how the drugs got in the system. Now, whether or not he believes that some of these cases are murders, and whether or not he believes that, there's too many questions in some of these drug overdose cases, he's not saying. But you also have 200 cases that in the latest report from 2007 that are ruled other, which means it wasn't intoxication or considered drug overdose. That's 200 cases. Drowning, someone with head injuries, somebody who fell, let me give you some interesting cases that are undetermined. I don't know if you remember. 3 years ago, a man named Ray Rivera was found in the second floor conference room of the Belvedere Hotel.
Oh, yes. He fell through
fell.
He went through
The second floor conference room, there was a ceiling, the Belvedere Hotel sort of
like a glass ceiling.
Yeah. And he went through that and he was found. His family and his wife has insisted and maintained consistently that he was not suicidal. He never would have gone up to the top of the roof. He never would have jumped. There was no reason for him to be up there. And the medical examiner has ruled it undetermined because they don't think there's enough evidence to say that he wanted to jump, nor he had no psychiatric problems, no pre-sort of depression or anything that would have indicated he would have committed suicide. That case is in sort of no man's land because it's ruled undetermined. There was another case of Tyra McClary, which I write about. She was found buried under a pile of mulch with a bag tied around her legs, who had thyroid hemorrhaging. The medical examiner said you can't rule out asphyxiation, but since the police didn't do any further investigation, the cases remained undetermined. So there are cases where there are questions that you know I don't think will ever be answered.
Now, when you talk to the police about why they don't take like the Rivera case or the case that you just mentioned of Jackie McClary's sister, who was found with her feet bound and
well, there's a bag wrapped around her leg. I don't want to miss there was
a bag wrapped around her leg. Okay,
yeah, okay. I don't want to say she was bound. Okay, that would be missing.
You're a journalist. So you have to make sure those things are right.
Right.
But in cases like that, what does the police department say about why they don't investigate further?
Well, the police department says, you know, when I talk to them, like in the case of Ray Rivera, they believe it's a suicide because there's no other explanation for it. You know, it's just a tricky case because they don't have any other, you know, according to the medical examiner, it's hard to determine if there are any injuries prior. In the case of Tyra McClary, I think they just look at it like, you know, it's another drug overdose. I mean, I talked to them, asked them about it, and they said there was not enough evidence to warrant a full homicide investigation. But on the other hand, you have the family members who say, we really believe this is true. Now, you got to understand, in the Baltimore City Homicide Department, they have more cases per officer. Three times the number of cases is recommended by the FBI. In other words, an officer is supposed to have three cases a year. In homicide, you can have up to 8 to 10 to 12 cases in Baltimore City High because we have so many murders. So I think it's sort of a matter of investigative triage where you say, look, this guy got shot in the head. This is a murder. But there's a little question. We don't want to increase our caseload. And also, there's a political reason to keep the numbers as low as possible.
Folks, what do you think at 410-319-8888? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We're talking with Stephen Janis, investigative reporter, founder of investigativevoice.com. His recent story on June the 1st, on Monday's story, was about doubtful deaths. The number of people, exorbitant number when you compare it to other cities that are ruled unknown sources of death. They're not investigated as murders. Many people in the community are talking about there are many more murders than we talk about every year that take place.
Yeah.
And maybe this is part of the story, maybe it's not. What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888 and why our medical examiner's office has so many doubtful deaths, unclassified deaths, compared to other cities of our size? 410-319-8888. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to say, I think when I looked at the national figures, there are about 5,000 undetermined deaths on a given year on a roughly average basis. So it means that we have close to, you know, 20% of those. So really are statistically anomalous in this case. But, you know, like I said before, a lot of it has to do with drug overdoses. I mean, if the police come...
Well, Baltimore is not the only city in America with lots of junkies.
That's true, but it's sort of a medical philosophy, I guess you could call it. I mean, I guess if you come upon a body in an abandonment, someone who there's no signs of visible injury, like their head's not blown open, and they have a needle sticking out of their arm, and they're dead, you know, where do you go with that? You know, a lot of people have told me, well, I know somebody who, you know, got in trouble with drug dealers, and they shot him up full of drugs, and they killed him. But on the other hand, is from an investigative standpoint, how do you prove that that's a murder, that's a homicide? So it's sort of like an uneasy truce between what you can do and what you can't prove. But I think Fowler is kind of saying, I don't think all these cases, I think he's saying to a certain extent they're not conclusive. Because if he felt conclusively that they were accidents, he would rule them accidents. It's a really interesting phenomenon in Baltimore.
So now what is going to happen? So what do you think the outcome will be here with, well, you can't.
Well, I can tell you that there is something happening, which is that City Councilman Belinda Conaway is going to hold a hearing. She's going to introduce a resolution to the City Council calling for an investigative hearing on the undetermined deaths and get Fowler. And I think there's going to be some public, you know, vetting of this issue, which has really stayed pretty much under the rug for a long time.
And there are also, I mean, that there are all these, what is it, 2,212 accidental deaths?
That's what the report said. Yeah, in Baltimore, obviously, and it's not funny, but like it's really another odd statistic that we have a high rate of accidental deaths in the city. And, you know, also I wrote a
story.
What's
an accidental death? Like somebody falling down the steps and in their head?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I mean, this is what the report said, you know, 2,000, which was twice the rate of PG County. So
yeah, you wrote here that in your article that Baltimore City had the highest number of accidental deaths of any jurisdiction in the state, 2,212 in 2007, no stats for 2008 yet. Twice the number in Prince George's County, which had 1,046 accidental deaths, that Baltimore is a much smaller jurisdiction than Prince George's County.
Well, I mean, you know, you can look at that. You have the homicide rate in Baltimore being, you know, higher than Prince George's County, you know, other counties, and even though they have higher public, I don't have any way to explain that, and I haven't had time to really look into that because I've still been looking at the undetermined and explain why accidental deaths are so high in this city. But there's another component to this too, which I wrote about two weeks ago, was that the Baltimore City Homicide Department has 200 pending cases from 2008, which means the cases haven't been determined at all. Now, I wasn't able to figure out, I wasn't able to get an answer from the medical examiner's office if those pending cases are undetermined. But those cases, they give them P numbers, they're questionable deaths, and I don't know if they've been ruled undetermined or they're just pending, but I found, you know, internal records that showed there were at least 200 cases from 2008 that were still pending.
So does that mean those 200 cases are not part of the homicide statistics from last year?
No, they're not. They're just questionable deaths that probably will be ruled, I would imagine, undetermined at some point. Maybe the medical examiner's already ruled them undetermined and it hasn't gone into the homicide database. And look, I know this is confusing. I'm just trying to illuminate it because it's something that, you know, the numbers that you see, for example, in the homicide rate, our homicide rate doesn't include justifiable homicides. In other words, if a police officer or somebody shoots someone and kills them and it's considered justified, that doesn't go into our homicide rate, for example. Or if you get hit by, I think sometimes even, you know, you have vehicular accidents where there's a question, those don't get ruled homicides. So there's, the statistics aren't as, you know, definitive as people want to believe or as they want to make you believe that, you know, it's exact science. I mean, there are some boundaries there that you can work with.
I mean, as I said, there are a lot of people who think that Ray Cook will be one of them on the show tomorrow as we mm-hmm. talk about the violence in our communities and the uptick in violence of people just having, as we call, beatdowns in the street for no seeming reason. That his argument is that has been, as many people has been, mm-hmm. that there are many more murders than we're talking about.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the other big, big component to this that people have to think about. I mean, I wrote a story about this like 2 years ago. You know, you also have, if you have, let's say 10% of undetermined are homicides, just the thing, and then you compile those with or compound those with the number of unsolved murders, okay, you could have a large number of people walking around the community who had committed a homicide who are never going to be punished nor prosecuted nor taken off the streets. So what this large gray area creates is a gray area for people who want to commit crime or who have bad intentions to sort of hide in it, you know, and this sort of statistical anomaly. And, if you look at the number of, we did a story about only half of all murder cases end up with prison time, then you got a lot of murderers walking around Baltimore City. You know?
What do you mean all half of all murder cases don't result?
Well, we did a study, and I'm just going off memory, called Cold Cases, Broken Hearts, where we looked at cases going back 10 years. How many were open? How many were closed? You know, the overall closure rate, I think, for the city had been like 47-50%, if I remember correctly. And of those, you know, only 25% ended up with prison time of more than 10 years, I think. So the underlying, and I'm quoting from memory, but it's pretty close. And so what the underlying theme you have here is that, you know, if you murder somebody and get away with it and you have a murderer walking around the community, that's not necessarily helping fix the violence issue going forward. In other words, investigative resources and closing these cases is more than just solving a riddle. It's about removing an element from the community who are our worst offenders and the most difficult, problematic members of society, anybody who decides that they want to take a life and then go ahead and do it. So that's why these numbers are worth looking at and examining from as many perspectives as possible, because you just don't know what's hidden in there.
So, and in the conversations you've had with the medical examiner's office or with
mm-hmm.
the police department,
I've talked to them a lot,
that, do they have any explanation for why we have so many of these cases that are unresolved or not determined
well,
how they died?
Well, for example, when I was looking at the pending cases, the homicide, the department told me that they're a lot of times you're just waiting for the results from the medical examiner's office. And when you talk to the medical examiner's office, they say sometimes it takes a while to even come up with the undetermined ruling, you know, because circumstances are so strange. So I think to a certain extent part of it is, you know, I don't think the medical examiner's office budget really, I think, reflects the reality of the amount of autopsies they have to do and the amount of cases that they have to deal with. I really don't think that people look at the medical examiner. Remember, we have one in a lot of states. They have a coroner in each county, but we have one medical examiner's office that deals with the entire state. So they have to do like 8,000, I think, examinations a year, some a couple thousand autopsies. They have 12 Emmys from what I remember. So, you know, I don't know if the budget matches the problem. I mean, sometimes I think that might be an investigative resources. If you have 800 people come in there without obvious, or 800 or 900 cases that come without obvious conclusions, you need more investigative resources. I mean, he won't say this to you when you ask him. But that's somewhat of what I've theorized, and I'm just speculating now. But right, and you're not supposed to do that as a journalist. But it is a question, you know, it is a tricky question.
410-319-8888. The calls are coming. We'll get to you right now. We're talking with Stephen Janis. He's written an article in his website, investigativevoice.com. He's an investigative reporter. Has been for many years. Worked with the Examiner when that thing fell apart. He created investigativevoice.com. And one of his stories has to do with the numbers of deaths, an inordinate number of deaths in Baltimore City that have remained undetermined. Don't know if they've been murdered, don't know if they OD'd and died, don't know if they committed suicide, don't know if foul play was involved. And many people that he's talked to and I've heard in the city have had relatives and friends who died, and they insist that these people just didn't kill themselves, that they were murdered, and that nobody can pay attention to these cases. And maybe this is a way to get some people to pay attention to what might actually be happening to people in the city of Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number. As soon as I get your names up on the screen, I will get you on the air here. 410-319-8888. I will be very curious to see how this kind of shakes out with City Hall, and also with just getting into the, well, it's just determining why this is taking place.
Yeah, I mean, I think what this really needs is a public airing, because you have to have, you know, all of this kind of occurs under the radar. I mean, it used to be that the medical examiner's office, from my understanding, posted their annual report online. But now it's much more difficult to get a copy. And it used to be you could get a copy of an autopsy for $40, and now it's $125. So it's kind of like difficult to penetrate.
I thought in this world everything was supposed to be online.
Well, I mean, I have been had trouble. I couldn't find it, and I finally just got a copy through other channels, let's say, because I had been asking for it and had not received it.
That's your job. 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones and see what people are thinking and what questions they have for Stephen Janis. Linda, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
I am wondering, I see that Dr. Fowler has a really high turnover rate for doing autopsies, about 24 hours from the time a body is received in the morgue or medical examiner's office. I'm wondering if the writer thinks that this contributes to the rate of unresolved cases. I understand other cities have backups for doing autopsies of months and even years. And I'll take my answer off the air.
That's an interesting question.
That's a really interesting question. And I'll be honest, it's the first time I've heard about that. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is in other cities, there's more funding for medical examiners. Medical examiners go to the crime scenes and also participate more in the investigative process. But I don't get that sense from what I've talked to people at the ME's office. It could be true that they do, but you know, possibly, yeah, that could definitely be a factor. You know, because it's really sometimes you got to do a little bit of investigation.
Let's try another caller here. 410-319-8888. Apollos, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, Stephen?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Mr. Steiner, I'm so glad to have this topic go out over your airwaves. My question is, and there's so many questions on this, the more you ask, the more you're going to ask, how does Baltimore compare to the rest of the state as far as this number of undetermineds?
Well, I mean, Baltimore has the highest percentage. You know, if you look at it on a percentage basis, I think in 2007 there were like 379 out of 900. So you'd probably have to see that's like 40% of the state's undetermined deaths. So by jurisdiction, as you know, you're talking about a city that has 600,000 people and a state a population of 5 million. So you have about 10% of the population here, but about 40% of the undetermined deaths, or a little bit less than 40%. So we have the highest rate of undetermined deaths of any jurisdiction in the state.
Thanks, Apollos. I'm glad you joined us. I tell you, the most shocking one to me is that we have 2,212 in 2007. That's on the statistics. Accidental deaths.
Yeah. I know.
I'd love to see somebody be able to go and probe. Well, and
I'm going to look into that because, you know, I was going through the statistics and that just struck me, and that's why I wrote about it. But that might be a good topic. You know, obviously I would urge people in the city to be careful because, you know, 2,000 accidental deaths having twice the rate of any jurisdiction is another category.
Well, and I don't mean to be paranoid, but I mean the people who want to off somebody, kill somebody, and who are involved in illegal activities and drugs and whatever else, are not stupid.
No.
People know how to fake people's deaths. People know how to make... I remember somebody saying to somebody who was a reporter once, if you don't stop looking at this, we have ways of making this look like an accident.
Oh, well, listen.
You know, I mean,
here, let's talk about everybody's favorite topic, not just Inner Harbor as a place where people get beat up, but bodies in the harbor. You know, there have been five or six of them. I was able to track down five. And the best thing to do if you want to kill somebody is throw them in water, have them float around for a month. And it gets very difficult to determine. It's not impossible, but difficult to determine injuries. And so we've had five, and every time there's a body in the harbor, people speculate, but I think it makes it extremely difficult for police. Those are probably some of the pending or undetermined cases, because how did the guy get in the water? You know, we just had a case 2 weeks ago, and the guy was depressed. You know, he was on medication, but he wasn't suicidal. He ends up in the water, and his family thinks, you know, they have no idea why. And so that's absolutely one of those cases where it might be ruled an accident. He accidentally fell into the water.
Well, Stephen Janis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air, and keep up the investigative work.
Thank you.
Investigative reporter Stephen Janis, founder of investigativevoice.com. Check it out on the web. He'll be back on here on a frequent basis talking about the stories he's working on. Great to see you as always.
Thank you.
Stay tuned, folks. But first, we're going to say the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite gets on board our transportation future with stories on how electric cars should change the city, the battle for the streets between drivers and bicyclists, and a possible second act for the great American streetcar. Available at over 700 locations around the region or online at urbanitebaltimore.com. We come back from this break, the first time ever that Gwen Ifill and Sherlyn Ifill have spoken live on the air together. They're going to talk with us about race, their issues facing race, in advance of their talk tomorrow night at Enoch Pratt Library at 7 o'clock. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Sherlyn Ifill and Gwen Ifill will be appearing on Thursday night at Enoch Pratt Free Library as part of the Open Society's new series, Talking About Race. The event starts at 7 p.m. You can go to osi-baltimore.org to find out more information. It's free and open to the public. You should attend. And, of course, Gwen Ifill is managing editor and moderator for Washington Week on PBS and a senior correspondent for the NewsHour. And author of Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Sherlyn Ifill is professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and is a commentator on the website roots.com. And they are both first cousins to boot. Gwen and Sherlyn, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
First time, Mark, ever. The two of us together.
Historic.
It is. This is great. This is great. I've always wanted to have this happen.
Except around Thanksgiving table.
Right.
Very heated.
It'll be very different today, I'm sure. Sherlyn, we have talked in the past just about your dad and about Gwen's father, both coming from Panama. And you described on this program and in other ways before that your father and being a race man in the kind of nomenclature of 20, 30, 40 years ago. And describing that, if both of you would, in terms of where you think we've come to in this conversation that will take place tomorrow night or tomorrow night.
Well, for me, you know, one of the things I hope and that we'll get a chance to talk about tomorrow night, and I think we probably will, is kind of, you know, how we begin to form our thinking about race very much influences how we talk about race throughout our lives. And, you know, I received a lot of lessons about race from my father, because he was, you know, when I was growing up, a social worker in Harlem. Before that, he had been an electrician. But when in my formative years, he was a social worker in Harlem, involved with a lot of youth programs. And so he was very politically minded, very socially conscious, and very aware of and conscious of race. And he made us aware of it by, you know, what he talked about in the home, by the news programs that he watched, by the three newspapers that were in our house, you know, regularly, along with, of course, the ubiquitous, you know, Jet magazine. But, you know, so he made me aware of, you know, race as a social construct. Race is also a source of pride, you know, as a way of understanding who you were, your background, and having a sense of self-esteem. And so I think that framing, you know, as a child helps you go forward in terms of thinking about race. At the same time, my father had, you know, some things that were just non-negotiable. You know, education was the most important. There was no excuse that you could offer that would justify, you know, why you did not excel in school. The idea that you were going to go to college, it was not a question. It actually didn't even come up as a question. The only question was where and how are we going to pay for it. So there were other, you know, very important pressing issues, the importance of family and so forth, that was very, very present. And all of those things, I think, kind of come into the cauldron that, you know, as you grow older and as you become an adult, kind of help become part of the stew. And then you have, you know, you have your own experiences, mm-hmm. obviously, that come into it as well. And you read and you learn also your parents didn't know everything. You go beyond them in some ways. You grew up in a different generation. But I do think that framing is very important. And sometimes I think we don't understand that people have different frames that they come from that help introduce them not only to what they think about race, but also how you talk about it.
Gwen Ifill?
I couldn't put it better, and I seldom try to. and here's the backdrop for Sherilyn and I. My father was the older of the two brothers. By coming to this country, I feel strongly that immigrants who choose to uproot their lives in order to make better lives for their children are incredibly courageous people. They came to this country, they were raised in Panama, where there was a lot of race consciousness, but not like in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they were exposed to it immediately. My father was a clergyman in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and even within the church, which is a black church, he still came up across the kind of the cross currents of race, which played out with immigrants and native born. But he raised children. Our parents raised a lot of children. A lot. Altogether, 16. They raised a lot of children to understand that there's nothing they couldn't do.
Right.
When Sherilyn describes bringing newspapers in the house and watching the news, we were always very keenly aware of the fact that our lives had something to do with what we saw happening in the streets, what we saw happening in marches on Washington, what we read in the newspapers. We saw the immediate and direct connection, and we also had the sense of expectation which was placed on us that we would be successes somehow. Our parents, our fathers were both I wonder if Sherilyn would agree with me, they were kind of accidental feminists, and that they weren't feminists by any standard you would apply. But they also didn't bother to tell their daughters what they couldn't do, by and large. And so they raised these incredibly accomplished women, even the ones who felt that we were, you know, struggling against our limitations that our parents put on us from time to time, who all turned out to be quite remarkable. And as a result, you know, with a little modesty I say this, but we have a remarkable family. And I think it has a lot to do with how you're raised. We were raised, for instance, that if someone used a racial slur, called you the N-word or... In my day, I'm a little older than Sherilyn, being called black was a slur, because we were Negroes, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So my father taught us that if we were called something that we considered to be, that was directed as a negative, we should say thank you. And I thought, to this day, it really works, no matter what the insult. Because people insult you hoping to get a negative response. But if you give them a response in which you empower the word and you empower the slur so it's no longer a slur, they step back, and therefore you have the upper hand for at least that moment. That's one way of dealing and talking about and living race. But both of our fathers were race men who didn't think it was incidental, who loved America, could sing some, you know, patriotic songs, but also understood it's what I think Condoleezza Rice called its birth defect is what she called it,
mm-hmm.
which is racism. And for people to now turn it on its head and pretend that racism is something else other than it was, than it is, or that it no longer exists, is to ignore our history and to ignore our present.
Both Sherilyn Ifill and Gwen Ifill, who you just heard, are in the studio now. They'll be appearing tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Library Open Science Institute. A new series on talking about race starts tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the downtown branch on Cathedral Street. We're in a political time that makes the discussion about race, some people think, more difficult, but in many ways may be more interesting and coming to the surface in different ways. A part of it for me has come to fruition over the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor, in that you hear the debate going on now, and the debate is built around that race, quote-unquote, race-based approaches to reforming society do not fit in. They're now antithetical and obsolete under Obama. Senator Cronin from Texas said that the American idea is that justice should be colorblind. And the critique of her, I'm not asking you to take a position on the critique of Sonia Sotomayor, but that she has stood in the past for consideration of race and hiring. But that is what kind of started the argument out for people. But now it's gotten to a place where we're really, this is where I think the fractious line is, one of the fractious line exists in America. Or whether a race conscious public polity is antithetical to the moment we're in. And I think that's a liberal left divide, a conservative divide at the moment, and maybe more. Shirley, why don't you start and go over to Gwen?
Well, so here's where we may have some departure, because, you know, I do think I can speak a little bit to the substance of it, but I think the point you're raising is a bigger one. I think people are being oversold on the idea that the conversation about race that we're having and the reality of race right now in 2009 has placed us in a moment in which race doesn't matter, or in which we can fully embrace colorblindness. It's actually quite interesting and even ironic that even as people say this, they are attacking the record of Judge Sotomayor in terms that are extremely racially laden and gender-based as well, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just use an example, because that's a larger conversation. The question about
I just want to focus on the
question about colorblindness. So let me just—I'll give a small example. Maybe this will help. I actually just wrote a piece that is going up on theroot.com today, and it's about the role of race in confirmation hearings. So right now we're in this big moment, you know, about Judge Sotomayor. This is the first Latina Supreme Court justice nominee, will likely be the first confirmed Latina Supreme Court justice. It's an important moment. It's a historic moment, not only for Latinos, but for the United States. Every time we move forward, every time we pass one of these barriers, it's important. Now, I'm not that interested, frankly, in what I call cosmetic diversity. That is, you know, a Supreme Court that looks like America. I'm interested in a Supreme Court that is like America. I'm interested in a Supreme Court that has justices on it who come from a variety of backgrounds, because I think it makes judicial decision making better. That's a, you know, separate conversation. But to pretend that the issue of race kind of arises in the context of Justice Sotomayor's comments in the speech that she gave in Berkeley, California, or arises in the context of the affirmative action cases currently in the Supreme Court that Judge Sotomayor was on the panel for in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the New Haven firefighters case, is really to ignore the history. And what I talk about in the piece I wrote today is that the modern confirmation hearing, as we know it, was basically created as a product of issues about race. Prior to Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, there were not regular Senate confirmation hearings of the kind that we're familiar with for Supreme Court nominees. It had happened on one or two occasions that there were specific charges against a particular nominee who came in and answered those charges to the committee. But it was only in 1955, the year after Brown, when John Marshall Harlan II was nominated for the Supreme Court, that Southern senators who were so up in arms about Brown decided that they wanted to question Supreme Court justices about how they saw Brown, what they thought were the limitations of the Constitution. And James Eastland, Senator James Eastland from Mississippi, was on the Judiciary Committee at that time and basically kind of running the show. And that was the first time that a Supreme Court nominee was brought in the way that we now recognize it to answer those kinds of questions. And it continued thereafter. It continued with Thurgood Marshall. And I won't go into all the details, but in the piece I go through white and black judges, that race and justices of color or nominees of color, race is always a central part of the issues that are raised by senators, the issues that are percolating in the public. Sometimes we call it by other names. We just talk about affirmative action, but we're talking about race. And so that's part of the problem, is that you can pretend when you're talking about affirmative action to nominee David Souter, right, in 1990, who, by the way, was opposed by the NAACP because he made a speech, in part because he made a speech in which he described affirmative action as affirmative discrimination. We can talk about that as though that's not about race, as though that nomination, you know, didn't have anything to do with it. Hers does, right? And what I'm suggesting is they all do in one way or another, because race is still such a central and important issue in the United States.
I think that's a very powerful argument you just made. And we can come back another day and do an entire program just about that idea, I think, because I think that's true. And so, Gwen Ifill, I'm curious, as you look at the political dynamic going on now and what you think that kind of debate portends for the future political debate taking place.
I'm a student of kind of language and juxtaposition. And one of the things I find interesting when we talk about race, and Sherilyn just made an interesting point, that why is it then when an issue is about race but the nominee is white that it's never considered to be about race? I'm curious about why it is that Sonia Sotomayor's connection to civil rights organizations is a negative when it would not be, or when her allegiance and her pride in her Puerto Rican heritage is considered to be about race, but when Justice Alito talked about his pride in his Italian heritage, it's considered to be about heritage. For some reason, when the person is of color or a woman, any kind of allegiance to who you are or any nod to part of who you are as being what shaped you is suddenly considered to be a point of friction and negative. Whereas if you're Irish-born or your parents immigrated from Eastern Europe, that's considered to be a point of pride. I'm not certain why it is that we're not allowed the pride. As I've been traveling this spring talking about the book I talked to you about, Mark, on this program,
mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things I've been getting is that we seem to be creeping slowly, black, white, green, whatever, toward this conversation we want to have about race, but we don't feel we've had the permission to have it. Because whenever it comes up, it's cast as a negative. It's cast as accusatory and grievance-driven. So when I am standing in front of audiences where people shyly walk up and say, you know, I'm just a white guy, but what is it with this? They are so relieved to have someone who's willing to answer their question without judgment. And I think that all arises from the fact that a lot of people feel pretty proud that they voted for Barack Obama, white, black, Republican, or Democrat. A lot of folks will come up and say that, and they would like to believe that therefore we have moved past this point or we've turned some corner, some hopeful corner. And I think to some degree we have. But I've talked to President Obama about this, and he doesn't believe we are at a transcendent point. He knows race will always be a factor. He's not the one out here saying, let's move past it. People keep saying he tried to be racially transcendent in his campaign. He tried not to talk about it. That's true. But that didn't mean he was trying to transcend. He understands what people see when they look at him. So this idea in our country, and it's kind of a crippling one, that whenever we talk about race, that it's automatically about conflict, that it's automatically about something negative, and there's nothing positive you can take from it, which is the assumption on the part of a lot of the critical senators about Sonia Sotomayor. The assumption is that, you know, I heard Senator Sessions say, the problem is, as a judge, she's supposed to be right down the middle. Well, not driven by political wins, which means that any judge who's ever been elected in this country, and many, many, many of them run for office, none of them qualify for the Supreme Court because they've been polluted somehow by the political. You know, once you take the standards you're applying to her and then apply them more broadly, they don't hold up. And then when you strip it all away, you realize it's all about race. And it's the justification for people's acting out their discomfort or hitting hot buttons for people who react the way they do. It's frustrating in some ways because we do take a step and a half forward and then a step and a half back on this subject. But I do think that there's a potential, and I do think that one of the reasons why elected Republicans last week were so unhappy about the unelected Republicans going after Sonia Sotomayor in the way that they did, one of the reasons they were unhappy is because they understood that that's appealing to an increasingly shrinking number of people, that kind of appeal.
Gwen Ifill is managing editor and moderator of Washington Week on PBS, a senior correspondent for the NewsHour, author of Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, which she spoke to about a number of weeks back. Sherilyn Ifill is a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of the book on the courthouse lawn, confronting the legacy of lynching in the 21st century, and a commentator on Roots.com.
TheRoot.com.
The Root. Thank you very much, Sherilyn. TheRoot.com. Did I say Roots?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. My mind went back to the 1970s. TheRoot.com. They will both they will both be appearing tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Library at 7 p.m. as part of Open Society's new series talking about race. And in talking about race, I wonder then, from what both of you have said, and what actually interesting, what both your books said, Sherilyn, your book was in a historical context, but very much talked about what that historical context meant for today's world. And Gwen, one of the parts of the eye-opening parts of your book for me was the new younger African American leadership across this country that is growing up in state legislatures and city councils and moving into Congress, potentially moving into Congress, and where both of you think then that this conversation goes. Because it's in a very strange place right now when you talk about race, because of what you all have just spoken about, and with a conviction.
Can I just say, Mark?
Go ahead, Gwen.
I think that we're in a more hopeful place than you might suspect. I really do think that there are loud minority of people who will always scream fire in a crowded theater, who will always go for the negative, who will always use the word racist when it doesn't apply and not use it when it does. There's always going to be that group of people out there. But I don't think that's where the broad swath of America is right now. I think the broad swath of America is a place where they have put their faith for the security of the country, for their own economic security, for their own retirement, you name it, in the hands of African Americans. That's a big, big, big deal. And as a result of that, they're listening, they're open, they're considering the possibilities. And I think that, however, the people who scream and yell will always get outsized attention for that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's where the country is.
Well, I would say that that's largely true. I actually think the moment we're in, what's exciting about the moment, is that it's an opportunity to integrate, for lack of a better word, multiple levels of conversation on race. I mean, what I love in reading Gwen's book is, you know, we're finally kind of exposing that there is a generational piece to this also that has to be addressed. You know, in my book, I was talking about the ways in which the lingering stories about these events, these traumatic events that happened in the 1930s, have also been seeded into generations. And, you know, and Gwen's book really shows how there are generations who kind of broken free of certain kinds of restrictions. Although I think many of them have internalized certain messages about race also. And I think what the election of Barack Obama has kind of portended is the idea of, kind of splitting the generational divide, that there is an opportunity now to have a much more integrated conversation about race, even within racial groups. I mean, you know, this is one of my pet peeves, Mark. I think people constantly think that when we talk about race, we're always talking about interracial conversations, you know, across race.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've told you, I think that, you know, very often we're not really prepared to have interracial conversations. There are a lot of intraracial conversations that have to happen around a variety of issues before we're really prepared. And sometimes the reason that we have a breakdown in conversations across race is because people haven't had enough conversation within their own racial groups, within their families, within their churches, within their communities. And so I think that that's what I see really as being really exciting right now is, we are in this moment in which something has happened that, you know, the majority of Americans got on board with, regardless of their background. And it does mean something. And it's provided a window, an opportunity for us to have a much richer, less slogan-driven conversation about race that is respectful of multiple generations. My daughter talks about race differently than I do. And I find myself, you know, learning a lot from her. I've seeded a lot into her, no question about that, just as my father did to me. But, you know, I think it's a moment in which we recognize that there isn't one conversation per race, you know, that there are multiple conversations. And we're going to have to recognize that the goal is not to herd us all into having one unified conversation, but to be able to have multiple dynamic conversations in a way in which we both speak, but also really hear each other.
And, you know, I'd love to also add that one of the things I thought most interesting about Sherilyn's book is exactly on this point, which is that the denial that happened within white communities on the Eastern Shore about what had happened in their own country, in their own towns. These lynchings had happened in plain view over the years. Everyone knew about them. No one talked about them. Generations passed, and it became, why do you want to dig into that? Why do you want to talk about that? There had been this conspiracy of silence, even among white people, about what their ancestors had done. That is an interracial conversation worth having. And that lack of that conversation is added to a scab and a scar, which is never healed. And that's what happens when we don't talk among ourselves. And that's where the generational splits happen. This is all of one great continuum, this discussion we're having. And it doesn't just involve a couple of us. It involves everybody on all these different levels. And it involves a willingness to open our ears and listen to someone who's formulated it, like Sherilyn's daughter, differently than we formulated it. I mean, I think our parents, if they were alive today, would still see this slightly differently than we see it, even though they've informed us. And we see it differently than our children. And that's fine. That's exactly how it should be.
Maybe this is a time we've come to where the complexities are really going to come to the fore. It's going to be a very, in some way, on some levels easier, some levels more complex, and in some levels even more difficult conversations to begin to have. I mean, I think we're in a very interesting historical moment.
We are, and I'm very, very excited by it. It feels very, and I don't know if Gwen shares this feeling also, but there is a part, you know, both our fathers are deceased, and I do wish my father could have seen the election of Barack Obama, and I do almost, you know, getting to Gwen's comment that she just made, I wonder what he would have said. I mean, my father was a tremendously plugged in predictor of political events. You know, so I wonder, you know, would he have been with the folks who, you know, right at the very beginning say, yes, this is the guy, this can happen, you know, or would he have said, no, it can never happen? You know, my father was not the guy who would have ever said, as, you know, Gwen's father did, that, you know, say thank you if somebody, you know, engages in a racial slur. He, you know, he was the youngest, he was the baby of the family, so he was a little, you know, fiery and temperamental. And so he wouldn't have said that. I looked at the primaries last year, and I just, you know, I wanted to be able to just call him, you know, what would he have said, you know, after South Carolina? What would he, because it would have been different, and it would have been interesting.
I would have given anything to be sitting there in the corner of the living room while our two fathers debated this.
Oh my God.
That would have been a hoot.
With a secret tape recorder.
These guys didn't have the access to the education and the worldview that we have, but they were the smartest than we knew on this stuff. And they would have constantly been revealing new things to us, constantly.
Yeah, and I'll add that, you know, one of the things, we didn't talk about this at the very beginning, Gwen, that I think is so interesting about even our fathers being from Panama is that my father talk to us about his exposure to American-style racism in Panama, because, of course, you know, Panama was very much controlled by the U.S., and certainly the Canal Zone was.
It was literally a colony.
And so, you know, their background was very poor, and so his conception of race, which, you know, Gwen is right, they didn't kind of experience it fully stateside until they got here, but this was a very racially segregated and stratified society that they grew up with in Panama at three levels, right? There were the black Panamanians who were largely, you know, came from their families came from other islands, Barbados, Jamaica, and so forth, to work on the Panama Canal. And you had the kind of Latino or mestizo population, and then you had the white Americans who were really running everything. So they came with a very sophisticated understanding of race from a country that had a kind of Americanized form of Jim Crow firmly in place. And that informed them. I mean, sometimes I heard the stories that my father would tell about racism in Panama, and it would blow my mind. I say that all to say that the immigrant experience actually can be quite important to our understanding of race, because we play out a lot of race experiments in other places in the world that come back to bite us on the behind, but they're part of the conversation. And as we move into this year, when we begin to talk about immigration, people need to recognize, and I say this to our own community, the African American community too, that this is part of the story, and we need this information to help enrich that conversation.
Well, this is just the tip of the iceberg, folks. You're just getting a little bit of what you might experience tomorrow night as we sit here and talk with Sherlyn Ifill, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and a contributor to TheRoot.com. And Gwen Ifill, managing editor and moderator for Washington Week on public television, and a senior correspondent for the NewsHour, author of the book The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Sherlyn and Gwen, first cousins, both leading thinkers in our country, will be appearing on Thursday night, at the Enoch Pratt Library as part of the Open Societies Institute new series, Talking About Race. Starts at 7 p.m. It's on Cathedral Street, right downtown, at Cathedral and Franklin. You can't miss that building. You know where it is, the Central Branch. And just show up at 7. Get there early, because there will be a line forming, I am sure, and a lot of people are going to be showing up. You can go to osi-baltimore.org for more information. And Gwen Ifill, Sherlyn Ifill, great to have you both on at the same time for the first time anywhere. Good to talk to you both.
Thanks.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 7 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.